This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Robert Morley, contributing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet Magazine and your undocumented radio host for Trumpet Hour. Joel Hilliker is out of town and he graciously asked me to fill in. And in case you're wondering why I said I was your undocumented host and not your illegal alien host, it's to make sure that I'm safe from being deported right out of this studio on my inaugural attempt. Well, that's the message we've all been hearing in America, right? You're not illegal, you're just undocumented. Welcome. Come on in. The borders are open. Our cities are sanctuaries for deportation, so make yourself at home. So if it works for the undocumented illegals, why shouldn't it work for undocumented radio hosts? Well, that's the hope anyway, but actually more on illegal immigration and undocumented aliens later. Thank you for listening. We have a great program for you today. Lots of important news to discuss, so let's get right to it. I have with me here in the studio some of our writing staff. We have our Asian analyst, Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
Richard Palmer via Skype from our news bureau in the UK. Hi, Richard.
Good afternoon.
Brent Noctegal, who follows the Middle East region.
Greetings.
And Anthony Chibarare, who is going to bring us up to speed with what is going on in the United States and the English-speaking world. Good to have you here, Anthony.
Hello.
Our top story today, let's get to it. It's also our cover story on the Trumpet Weekly. And the story this week asks the question, are the feds taking over policing in Baltimore? Are the feds taking over policing in Baltimore? Anthony, what is going on in Baltimore?
Okay, the media probably took off its eyes off from Baltimore since Freddie Gray, but there has been a lot of violence in Baltimore, a lot more than they have seen before. In the month of May, there have been 42 homicides in just the month of May, and that's a lot worse than before Freddie Gray. So there's a lot going on in Baltimore. The police, they're struggling, actually, and they're now calling in the feds to help them.
So the feds are actually being invited in by the local police to do policing matters in Baltimore.
Exactly. And just about the police department itself, I think it was back in July, the police commissioner was fired by the mayor because they didn't think that they were doing enough. And if you recall, this is the same mayor who, back when the riots were happening, actually asked the police to stand down. Those were her words. I actually have a quote from her. This is what the mayor said back in April, during those riots in April. She said, "While we tried to make sure that police officers were protected from the cars and the rioting that was going on, we also gave those who wished to destroy the space to do so." So this is the mayor who is telling the police to stand down, to hold back, and what happens from that? There's more violence, more homicides, and now the police cannot do the job, and they need the help of the feds to do that.
So let me get this straight here. We have these massive riots that took place in Baltimore. The mayor condemns the police for being heavy-handed, even though she's told them to hold back and give the looters space to riot. So now after this, the police have said, okay, you don't want us to be involved. You don't want us doing the job. You're calling us too heavy-handed. Let's back off. Let's see how things go. We won't do the job that we have been doing. And now we're seeing crime spike through the roof. We're seeing the homicides at record levels that we're seeing take place. I think I read somewhere that it was in the neighborhood of the highest crime rates since the 1970s. And now we have the situation where the police, the mayor is calling in, the feds are saying the police aren't doing the job. We're having crime rates go up. The city's out of control. We need the feds to come in and take care of things. So what's So what's significant about that in your opinion? Is there a danger with bringing the feds in to do policing?
They have they worked out a 2-month partnership with the feds, and there are 10 federal agents that will join the Baltimore Homicide Unit to help out in the situation in Baltimore. And this really is, as one of the deputy commissioner himself, he acknowledged that this is unusual. He said, quote, "This is a flipping of the script of sorts." Why? Because traditionally and historically, it's the police department who are helping out the feds, who are embedding with the feds to help them out in certain situations. But this is the other way around, where you're having the police call in the feds to help them out. And essentially what we're seeing here, based on what the police department has been doing, what the mayor has been doing and saying, is that they're handcuffing the police, essentially asking them to back down, let the violence play out, give people space to destroy, create a situation where you actually need the feds to come in, and then the feds will take control. Then the feds will be in control of the situation.
Right. This is what I find so disturbing about this story. I mean, if you look back historically, like you said, in America's founders, they were very clear about having a nationalized police force, a federalized police force. That's why the army wasn't allowed to do policing in America, right? This was the whole idea beyond that. But here we see now a situation developing where we're having the first beginnings of federal agencies actually acting and doing policing matters, when here the founders enshrined in the Constitution, in the law, that it was supposed to be the local levels, the state level, that does the policing. And they did that for a very specific reason, didn't they? They did that because they wanted to make sure that no tyrant could ever take over. There couldn't be the abuse of power that they had fought against. They fought for their freedom from Britain over. And now we have a situation where the federal government is increasingly inserting itself into localized police forces. And the police forces are even asking for it. And we're seeing this in a lot of different ways. Thank you, Anthony, very much for bringing this subject. This is something we need to be watching very closely. We are seeing that many federal agencies now are having their own SWAT teams and police forces, and they're taking into their hands a lot of the policing duties that traditionally have been left to local departments. I'd really like to encourage all of our listeners to visit thetrumpet.com and to look for this article on the website, "Are the Feds Taking Over Policing in Baltimore?" and to click on a link that you can find within that article that will take you directly to an article written by Gerald Fleury titled "Police Under Attack." That article will put what's happening in Baltimore into context for you, and it was a cover story for the August edition of the Philadelphia Trumpet. But since we're talking about America, since we're talking about the United States, let's stay with that theme. There was a lot of important news that happened this week within the English-speaking world. The media was filled with stories about the upcoming Republican presidential debate. I'm sure we've all heard a lot about that, the debate that took place yesterday. But there was a lot of other news that got overshadowed by that event. So beyond that, Anthony, give us a rundown on some of the more important news stories from the English-speaking world.
A couple of these news stories, they relate to the economy. The first one, the government of Puerto Rico on Monday confirmed that it will fail to pay $58 million that the government owes. This is the government of Puerto Rico. It owes $58 million, and it can only pay 1% of that. And the entire debt of Puerto Rico, that's including corporate debt, it's up to $72 billion, and they cannot pay that either. And the government of Puerto Rico asked for the right for Puerto Rico to file for bankruptcy and receive some protection, but the White House so far has said that it has no plans to bail out Puerto Rico. And analysts are just saying that this should serve as a cautionary tale for U.S. taxpayers about how debt heaped upon debt will one day meet its reckoning. So that's one item. And the second item is about credit card debt here in the United States. This article is from My Budget 360, and it says that credit card debt in the United States is like crack cocaine for the American consumer. And it's saying that Americans are just spending money that they do not have. The total outstanding credit card debt recently has surged beyond $900 billion. $900 billion in credit card debt.
Wow, so we're seeing the same thing at the personal level that we're seeing at the local level. We're seeing Puerto Rico, we're seeing individuals. It's just, as you said, debt upon debt upon debt. We're the United States of debt, it appears, Anthony. Okay, tell us about what you thought was the big story from Anglo-America this week.
Well, the big story, on Tuesday, United States President Barack Obama met Jewish leaders at the White House. Well, the purpose of this meeting, it was a two-hour meeting. The purpose of this meeting was for him to convince these Jewish leaders to not pressure lawmakers, to not lobby lawmakers, to push them to kill the nuclear deal with Iran, because that's what they've been doing. Jewish leaders have been trying to do all they can to pressure Congress to not support this deal. So basically, the president held this meeting to persuade the Jews to not push for Congress to kill this deal. But he went over just persuading the Jews. He actually threatened them. He told them that if you do not support this deal, then Iran is going to continue building its nuclear weapons. And as the United States, we're going to be compelled to attack Iran. But then he said, Iran, when it responds, it will not attack the United States. It will attack Israel. So it is in your best interest to support the deal, because you'll be the ones hit first by this deal. And I think that's terribly unfair for the American president to say that, especially because you've had people like Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, who has been warning the United States, warning the world about the dangers of Iran, about the dangers of a nuclear Iran, about how hostile it is, about its desires, its intention to wipe Israel off the map. He has been saying that. He's been warning that. He came to Congress to say this exact same thing. Iran is a dangerous nation. It's the number one terrorist sponsoring nation in the world. And Israel is right in the Middle East, and it's very close to Iran, and it can be wiped off the map. That's why Iran has been making those statements. But the Obama administration has been brushing that off, But now you're seeing the president saying, if you do not support this deal, then we are going to attack Iran. Iran is going to retaliate by attacking Israel.
Yeah, terribly, terribly disturbing. What I find that just stands out about this to me is that here we have a president pushing members of Congress to accept a deal that everybody knows is going to end up with the Iranians getting the pathway to the bomb after 8 years or 10 years or whatever it is they get the bomb. And here he is telling leaders that you accept this deal, otherwise they're going to attack you. They're going to use terrorism against you. In the end, you're going to be attacked. But here we are making a deal with a nation that he's admitting is a terror-sponsoring nation that's willing to use terror. So how do we trust these guys? How do you trust nations that want to kill you? Great question. I don't know if we have an answer to that. Do you have a feel, Anthony, for whether or not this deal is going to go through?
There's now quite a lot of opposition, even, first of all, let's just start from these Jewish leaders. There are some Jewish leaders who actually, even after all of those threats, they are supporting Americans who are against this deal. So there was an article from Commentary Magazine that said that, you know what, these arm-twisting tactics are not working because the Jews, even some of the Jews who have been supportive of the Obama administration, they are backing away from it. And then we have even a lot of Democrats, people on the same party as the president, who are trying to kill that deal.
Right. So this morning, I think you probably heard the news that Chuck Schumer, the New York Democrat, some people say he's poised to take over the leadership of the Democratic Party in the Senate, said that he was going to vote to oppose the deal. So we're seeing support even within the Democrats, as you brought out, of starting to break down. Some people say this could be like the first hole in the dam, that other Democrats will start coming out now and maybe kill this deal. Do you have an idea, or can you give us an idea of what might happen if this deal was rejected? Is it going to be catastrophic, like the president said? Is it going to be something that will completely destroy America's reputation? The world will turn on America, will be isolated. Do you have a feel for that?
Certainly, because the United States has been promoting this deal more than anyone else. So if this deal collapses, it's going to be a huge blow for the Obama administration, obviously, because of all the publicity. And also, it's going to be a huge blow to the United States in overall, because the world is going to turn away from America. It's not going to see this. The world is not going to give support to the United States because it failed on this
important deal. It can't seem to get its act together over here.
It cannot.
Well, that's interesting. One thing that I did notice that has come out recently is France's foreign minister. And there's actually been a little bit of pushback from France saying that this is a bad deal. And they're actually kind of hoping that Congress kills it. So, and I think one of the points he brought out is that if Congress rejects it, he'd actually be kind of happy about that, because then we'd have to go back to the negotiations and maybe we'd end up with a situation like Benjamin Netanyahu said, is not accepting any deal, but getting, you know, the alternative, getting a good deal. Thank you very much, Anthony, for that. These articles are in this week's Trumpet Weekly, a very informative, high quality report that comes out each week that contains the most significant stories and the best commentary from the very best sources. I'd like to encourage you to subscribe to this free weekly news report. Just go to thetrumpet.com and become a subscriber. Coming up next, the news from the Middle East, Asia, and Europe, and later our lightning round of important headlines from all our panelists. And then, after that, a special treat. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
This is Trumpet Hour with your undocumented radio host, Robert Morley, filling in for Joel Hilliker this week. You are listening to our Week in Review program, looking at the big stories from around the world. From the past week, we have been talking about the Iranian deal and the president's comments that if Congress rejects the deal, Israel will bear the brunt of attacks and terrorism, and that Iran is sure to unleash. Let's now stick with the Middle East. Let's go to Brent Noctegal. Brent, tell us what's been happening in the Middle East.
Well, I've just got three stories at the top here. The first one relates to the former hardline president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. He is back. He's launched his political campaign in hopes to return to office when they have elections in February. And it seems like he does have a small groundswell of support. We know right now we have what they're calling a moderate, Hassan Rouhani. As the president, he's the one that they've been able to ink this nuclear deal with. What happens when an even more hardline leader gets in power with Iran after this? Do they want to keep the deal? Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has been talking pretty anti-deal. So we'll see what happens when the next, if in fact he does come into power in February, we'll see. Another story, China appears to have inked a deal with Iran to sell them 24 fighter jets. How does Iran have the money? Well, they don't yet, because sanctions have not come down. They're still going to come down pending the deal being ratified by the different governments. So what do they have to sell? What do they have to give away? Well, what they're going to do is open up one of their oil fields for 20 years and give China access to that. So this story is highlighting the fact they don't even have money yet, and yet they're still getting what they want. They're giving away stuff, bartering, not with cash. So then when they get cash, what abilities will they have? Now, the next story just is just something to look for in the oncoming week. There have been a lot of diplomatic efforts, it seems, to end the Syrian conflict this week. We had meetings between Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry. He met with the Saudi officials as well and the rebel groups inside Syria. And it looks like they might have some type of idea of solution coming forward that may not include Assad. I don't think Iran is too happy with this. Maybe Iran is behind it as well. We're not sure. But there is movement there. So people should be looking to Syria right now to see what's going to happen this next coming week.
Okay, Brent, lots going on, obviously, but what did you think was the big story?
The big story was reported by Bloomberg View, and it's entitled "Iran Already Sanitizing Nuclear Site, Intel Warns." Now, this came out August 5th. It's written by Josh Rogan and Eli Lake. They're two of their writers that tend to jump on these stories to it's called in an unclassified section, I guess. So they like breaking these stories, and it is something worth breaking. Mr. Stephen Flurry talked about this earlier today on his Trumpet Daily radio program. But it is in the Trumpet Weekly, so it's worth people going to that and actually reading it themselves and not just taking away the audio from it. But what this article is about, I'll just read the opening two paragraphs. It says, "The United States intelligence community has informed Congress of evidence that Iran was sanitizing or scrubbing or cleaning its suspected nuclear site at Parchin in broad daylight days after agreeing to the nuclear deal with world powers." So in middle of July, they sign this deal. Yes, we want to move forward with a civil nuclear program. We're not developing nuclear weapons. We, of course not. We don't do that type of thing. And part of this deal is that the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, is going to have access at some of those sites where we believe, or the United States international community believes, Iran has done nuclear work before, undisclosed nuclear work, work that had bad intents to it, that they were going to use for a nuclear weapon. So part of the deal says the IAEA inspectors are going to go and have a look at their sites. The biggest site that they wanted to look at is this site in Parchin. It's a military base, so you can see that Iran doesn't want the United States or their enemies having a look at their military base. So they work it out that the United States won't go in and inspect it. The IAEA will go in and inspect it. Now, it turns out with this site that once the deal has been struck, those bulldozers are seen via satellite imagery. This is satellite imagery that's available to not the intelligence agencies. It's open for anyone to see. Bulldozers are at the site. The work was being done on top of two buildings there. And it looks like they're actually trying to clean up this site before inspectors get there.
But wait a minute, Brent. I thought the Ayatollah had issued a fatwa on nuclear development for weapons purposes. Why are they scrubbing something?
That is a very good question, why they're doing it. Now, I'm not going to answer that. Sorry, I believe that was rhetorical. But what we see here is the United States knows that they had past military dimensions to their weapons, to their nuclear program. The IAEA knows this. So they're taking it, you know, the United States government was approached by this and saying, well, you know, you just signed a deal and now they're scrubbing down the site that we want to go and inspect. How do you feel about this? The United States government comes back and says, well, you know, we already know the extent. Our intelligence agencies we already understand what they did. What we are concerned about is what they're going to do in the future. But if they know exactly what they did, you would suppose that Iran would believe that they knew exactly what the Iranians were doing. So why is Iran going to the effort to scrub a site that the U.S. believes that they already know was used for nefarious purposes with a nuclear program? Obviously, something happened there that Iran believes they can hide. So the Senator Kerry and the IAEA, they believe they'll get access into the site to discover this. And, you know, what are they going to find? Well, Iran believes they have 2 months here before mid-October when the inspectors technically can get in there. And they believe in those 2 months they can hide whatever they were doing before.
Yeah, we'll probably won't find out what exactly they have until they announce to the world that they're a nuclear power. That's just the world we live in. Moving, let's head off to Asia now. Thank you very much, Brent, for that report. Jeremiah Jacques, our Asian analyst, tell us what we need to know about Asia this week.
Well, we saw news break this week of another spy scandal, this time with the United States getting caught spying on what is probably its staunchest ally in Asia, Japan. So the U.S. has apologized to the Japanese for this. It was the result of a WikiLeaks document that was leaked out. But the Japanese are very unhappy about it. They feel like their privacy has been violated by a power that they've placed so much trust in.
So who haven't we spied on now? That's kind of the question.
That's true. That's true. And if this particular spy scandal creates a rift between Washington and Tokyo, it could really lead to some great shifts in the geopolitics of the Asia-Pacific.
So just for context, our other closest ally, Germany, same sort of thing, right? In recent months and years, the relationship we had between them and us and our intelligence agencies is at all-time lows. And now we're seeing this happen with our most important ally in Asia.
That's right. We keep getting caught doing these espionage campaigns, and it's really souring our allies' view of us. In Russia this week, we saw millions of locusts descending on farmlands and devouring entire fields of crops. So far, at least 800,000 hectares of land have been devoured by the insects, and officials in the affected region have declared a state of emergency. So it's a pretty big story there for Russia. And then this week, we also saw an analysis published by the National Interest saying that Russia and China teamed up together could make, quote, big trouble for America. The analysis says a concentration of Russian and Chinese naval forces in a discrete maritime theater could be enough to complicate Washington's ability to project power and to, you know, enough to really present a viable threat to America's military power.
Well, thanks for that, Jeremiah. I know you have another story you're anxiously waiting to talk about here. Kind of ties in with your last one. Tell us about what's the big story you want to bring to us today.
Sure. The most significant story, in my view, is that Russia is redoubling its efforts to take over the Arctic. This week, the Russian Federation submitted a bid to the United Nations that would place vast territories of the Arctic under Moscow's official control. The area in question is about 460,000 square miles, and it includes the North Pole. Russia says they have enough evidence to prove to the UN that all of this land should be a part of Russia's sovereign territory. And some may say, who wants the Arctic? It's, you know, it's just a dead region of sub-zero temperatures and infinite ice. But this region is believed to contain one quarter of the Earth's undiscovered oil and gas reserves. It's also believed to be very wealthy in gems and precious metals, so it's extremely valuable. And there are several other nations who have staked a claim to areas that Russia is now claiming. These other claimants include Canada, the United States, Norway, and most significantly, I believe, Denmark. Moscow has already planted a Russian flag on the ocean floor right there at the North Pole to sort of make a symbolic claim to its territory. The Kremlin in recent years has also really significantly beefed up Russian military forces all throughout the Arctic. They've restored and reopened a major Soviet-era military base. They've opened brand new bases, and they've conducted sweeping military maneuvers that included some 38,000 troops. There are many different aspects to this new claim and to Russia's militarization of the Arctic, everything from Moscow's ability to control the United Nations to the environmental implications. But the most important aspect of it, geopolitically and prophetically, is just that it shows Russia's ongoing push under President Vladimir Putin to expand, to rise up from the ashes of the Soviet Union as a really formidable power.
Right. And as we've talked about, there's lots of implications for Europe and the rest of the world from these kind of actions. Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Moving on to Europe now, we'll turn to our European correspondent, Richard Palmer. Tell us what the stories are from Europe this week that we need to know about.
Well, Greek bailouts are back in the news to a certain extent. You may remember that at the conclusion of the whole Greek drama last month, the EU and Greece put together a bridging loan, and that was to keep Greece afloat for about a month while they finalized the more permanent deal. and Greece has to have that new permanent deal in place by August 20th, and that's when that bridging loan expires. And already things may be falling apart. The IMF is raising some tough conditions. There's growing dissatisfaction on all sides. So watch August 20th. We could have an eruption of the euro crisis again already around that date. We spoke a little about immigration and Germany on this program last week, and that was in the news again this week. According to figures, official figures released this week, 11 million immigrants are now living in Germany. That's the highest number ever. And Germany is set to take in 500,000 refugees this year. And again, that's the highest ever. So immigration is going to become a bigger and bigger deal in Germany. And then finally, France officially cancelled a contract to sell two warships. They were helicopter carriers to the Russian Navy. And it's been talked about them cancelling this for a while, but it was all made official this week. And that's a big deal for France. They resisted making that cancellation for a long time. The contract was worth over $1 billion. These ships are built to the specifications of Russian helicopters, so it's going to be very hard for them to find another buyer for them at a good price. But they cancelled the contract, and that shows just how far Russia/EU relations have deteriorated over the past few months.
Richard, the big story.
Yes, the big story I'd like to talk about is a new and real push for a Eurozone tax. We touched on this a little bit last week, but Spiegel has an article that they published just about almost exactly a week ago that reveals some of the behind-the-scenes details in this planning for a brand new Eurozone tax. And before we go into some of the specifics of this, I'd like to review just this, why this is so significant. Because at first, it doesn't really sound like a big deal. You know, it's just yet another tax.
Right,
I could hear death and taxes.
Right, I could hear a lot of our readers starting to tune out taxes. Please explain to me why this is important.
Right, yeah, and as the Spiegel article talks about, a common taxation system is really the bread and butter of how you bring a federation together. Right from the Roman Empire all the way through to the early days of the United States. And so in that article, Spiegel writes, politicians in the Eurozone are now seeking to emulate the historic model from the early years of the United States. So that's what's important here, is they are copying a tried and tested recipe for building a federation, for building the political union that everybody now sees is necessary to stop the Eurozone falling apart. And so they also write, in Brussels and Berlin alike, financial experts are devising plans to provide the Eurogroup with the same tool that has has proven to be so successful throughout history, its own tax. And last week we talked a bit about the French president François Hollande's call for a new Eurozone government. And Spiegel writes that the German finance minister Wolfgang Schäuble believes that Hollande's plan does not go far enough. And they say that his officials are drawing up plans for the EU, or for the Eurozone, sorry, to have its own either income tax or sales tax, some very lucrative and secure form of revenue. And they said that Mario Monti, the former Italian prime minister, for the last little bit, he's been heading up a task force on Eurozone integration. And we've not heard much from that task force, really. He's been pretty quiet. They write, or Spiegel writes, that he is developing plans behind the scenes to put this kind of tax in practice. And they say that Jean-Claude Juncker, another very important figure in the European Union, is on board with this and supports this. So you've got some of the most important people and the most powerful people in the European Union now actively pushing for this European tax. But then even more than that, as we've covered quite a lot on this program, just the logic of the euro itself and the common currency is forcing a political union that will include a common tax. And as the Spiegel article concludes, if the economic government fails, so will the euro. So this is a life or death issue for the whole EU project, really. And so they're going to work really hard now on moving forward with this.
Wow, exciting stuff out of Europe. We're seeing the building blocks, the last things that we need getting put into place to see. As the Bible prophesies, prophecy tells us is coming, this United States of Europe. Very exciting. Thank you, Richard. You're listening to the Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review program. Coming up next, our lightning round of important headlines from our panelists, and then after that, our special treat.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
We're back. You're listening to the Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review. I'm Robert Morley, your undocumented radio host, filling in for Joel Hilliker this week. One last look from the headlines for this week that caught our attention. I'll go ahead and start things off. This week in Venezuela, it's looking like a war zone. The central bank has revealed numbers indicating the rate of inflation, which is now into the very high double digits. Everybody knows it's a lie, and inflation is much higher than that. Store shelves are becoming bare. There's long lines for what food the government is making sure gets to the people. And most recently, their equivalent of the Federal Reserve, their central bank in Venezuela, has told banks in certain provinces that they have limits to how much money that people can take out of their own bank accounts. So people now are being prohibited from withdrawing their own money. We're seeing conditions in Venezuela become very similar to what is going on in Greece, except in Greece we're having deflation destroying that economy, while in Venezuela we're having poor government cause inflation and hyperinflation, and people's savings are being destroyed. And now the government isn't even allowing people to protect what little savings they have by withdrawing their money and using it to buy food even, or other basic necessities. Venezuela, Stratfor this morning had a piece out in Venezuela saying it's approaching the time where the government needs to make some tough decisions. The implication is if this is prolonged, there could be civil war. That's what comes next in many cases after these kind of situations develop. For America, the lesson is we have similar problems not too far from this. In Puerto Rico, we have many of the same policies, socialist policies that Venezuela has adopted, maybe not to the extreme, but they are headed that direction. So be warned, what's happening in Venezuela, the socialist paradise, could be coming to America sooner than what we would hope. Okay, moving on. Brent, go ahead. Tell us what's your second most important headline from your region.
Well, this Thursday, there was a pretty important meeting or a big celebration, really, in Egypt, where the president, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, he hosted a bunch of world leaders, and they were celebrating the opening of the Suez Canal Part 2. There was an extension or a widening at some points, and then another canal alongside it as well. They've been working on this for a number of years. It cost $8.5 billion. And again, the Suez Canal, that's that waterway that connects the Indian Ocean to the Mediterranean Sea. So it's really critically important. About a quarter of the Middle Eastern oil comes through there. And now the widening of this canal and the extra lane that it's created, it allows even bigger oil tankers to be able to come through the Suez Canal instead of going around the Cape of South Africa. They can go straight into Europe that way. And instead of transit times taking 8 hours to get through the Suez Canal, that will now take 11 hours as well. So we're seeing that this opening is really allowing for a greater influx of shipping through the Suez Canal. Now, why is this important? Why do we watch this? Of course, this is going to boost Egypt's economy, probably help out its president gain some more of its populace's support. But we also know that Iran has its eyes on the waterway all the way, again, from the Persian Gulf, again, through this Suez Canal into the Mediterranean Sea. Now, Mr. Flurry has come out and talked about this, how they have a Red Sea strategy. They want to control this vast waterway. And now it got just a little more important. It is a greater target for Iran now. If 25% of the Middle Eastern oil came through there, before, how much more of it is going to come through to Europe now? It is a more lucrative spot. And it's if they control that, then they can obviously impact global affairs much more greatly. And that's what they want to do.
Thank you, Brent. Moving on to Asia. Jeremiah, tell us your number two story.
Well, China is not the only nation hacking the U.S. military. Russia is doing it, too. This news just broke yesterday, but the attack actually occurred back on July 25th. The Russians took down the Joint Staff Unclassified Email System. It affected some 4,000 military and civilian personnel. And the email system has actually been offline now ever since that attack, so for almost 2 weeks. And U.S. officials are calling this hack the most sophisticated cyber breach in U.S. military history. The level of sophistication strongly suggests that it was not just some rogue Russian individuals perpetrating it, but that it was a state entity. On the Trumpet Hour, we've talked about the red line that President Obama drew back in April regarding cyber attacks. He said, if anyone conducts attacks on, you know, the U.S.'s cyber property, then there will be these consequences. We will punish them. And then not even within a month, it was revealed that China had conducted a massive attack on us. Now we have this one from Russia. And although he made those very bold threats sort of against anyone who would potentially do this, there's no action that's been taken against China. Very little is likely to be taken against Russia. It just shows how far we've come since the days of U.S. President Theodore Roosevelt and his policy of walking softly and carrying a big stick. Now it seems like we speak loudly and carry a toothpick.
Wow. Thanks for that, Jeremiah. The red lines are not working. Anthony, bring us back to the English-speaking world. What was your number two story this week?
Well, this story is from California, and it's about illegal immigrants. If I should use politically correct language, I should say undocumented immigrants. Now, this is a problem that the United States has had for years, illegal immigrants, so that's not really new. But what's new is that in the city of Huntington Park, the city council just recently appointed two illegal immigrants into a government office. They'll be serving as commissioners. One will be serving on the Health and Education Commission, and the other will be serving on the Parks and Recreation Commission. Now, this follows a trend of just lowering the standards, just allowing those immigrants to come. In 2012, President Obama had his executive action called the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, which said that if you came into the United States before your 16th birthday, and if you came before June 2007, you could get a renewable two-year work permit, and you'll be exempt from deportation. Now, in 2014, he lowered that bar and changed that to, if you came into the United States before your 16th birthday and before June 2010, so the standards were being lowered, and also they actually scraped the requirement that the applicants needed to be younger than 31. So even with all of that, these two illegal immigrants did not even qualify for that. They didn't meet those standards, so they should have been deported. But what did the city of Huntington Park do? They employed them to a government office.
I thought that illegal immigrants only came here to do the jobs that Americans didn't want to do.
Exactly. That's the point. They're getting a consul job. They're commissioners.
Right. Now they're getting leadership positions.
Leadership positions right in the country. And it's a sad story. It's a trend that just shows how bad the situation is getting. Check our article online, Borderline Breakdown. It explains all the extent of this problem and where it's leading.
Thank you, Anthony. And Richard, bring us home. Number two story.
Yes, I want to talk about space, one of my favorite subjects, but this is a very frustrating story. After years and years of bad decisions in government and elsewhere, of mismanagement, of pork-barreled politics, in 2011, NASA was forced to rely on Russia to get its astronauts and its cargo up to the International Space Station. And back in 2011, that was a very bad situation. You know, having a huge part of America's access to space reliant on the goodwill of a foreign country was, even back then, not a good place to be. Now fast forward to 2015. Look how much the world has changed since then. Russia has now become an out-and-out enemy of the United States. America is placing sanctions on Russia. Yet this week it emerged that NASA is renewing its contract with Russia. They are going to give Russia $500 million to continue carrying U.S. astronauts up to the Space Center until 2019. And like I said, it was a bad decision back then. It is an absolutely insane decision right now, and it's just a pathetic state for America's space endeavors.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you, gentlemen. I'm Robert Morley, your undocumented radio host, filling in for Joel Hilliker, and we are coming to the end of another Trumpet Hour. And so far, I have avoided being deported from the studio. But before we let you go, the special treat we've been promising you, Brent, you have some very interesting news out of Israel for us.
Yeah, there was an excavation that's been taking place this summer in Tel El Safi. That's the biblical city of Gath, or Gat in Hebrew. This is one of the five major cities of the Philistines. No doubt people know them. One of enemy number one from the time of Samson all the way through till the time of David when they were finally defeated. But there was an excavation going on there for the past 20 years, and they were unable up to this point to find the city gate. Now, this week it broke that they did in fact find the massive fortifications around this city gate. They found it late in the season, so there's still a lot more digging to be done there. But this gate is pretty important. I mean, in ancient cities, the gate was where all the business transactions were done. We simply think of a gate as an entry point, but it was an assembly point back then. A lot of the time, the kings would sit at the gate as people came in and discussed business and such. And this gate complex, they won't tell us how big it is, but they say it's one of the largest in Israel, which would be huge. I mean, if it's going to be the largest gate in Israel, it would be in the vicinity of somewhere around 3,000 or 4,000 square feet. So this is a pretty big footprint that this gate would take up. And it is important because it shows how accurate the Bible is in describing not just Israel, but its enemies as well. If this nation of the Philistines were to be such a hindrance for the Israelites all through the reign of Saul, especially the 40 years that he reigned, they must have had a large kingdom. And what they're finding is that is exactly right. Connected to this gate was the fortification line as well of the city. So if you find this, then you have an idea at how big the city was, how many inhabitants were in there. And it's far larger than they thought. Now, Gath is important to us because it is the home city of Goliath, the Philistine that David fought in the Valley of Elah, just a couple of miles away from this city. That's where he came from. So it's good to finally uncover that, to see just how big that city was. It was also a location where David tried to get away from Saul, and he took refuge in the city of Gath. As well, and a whole host of biblical history took place there, and here they are uncovering it, bringing it right back out of the ground.
Wow, that's just fascinating, Brent. Thank you very much for that. The stones are speaking in Israel once again. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive your free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. All of these stories we discussed today are there, as well as links to Trumpet articles with more explanation. Send us your thoughts, questions by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Follow us on Twitter @@thetrumpet_com. Follow us on Facebook and Google+. Just search Philadelphia Trumpet. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Richard Palmer, Brent Noctegal, and Anthony Chibarare.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I will leave all you news watchers with some admonition given to us from the News Bureau's late chief, Ron Fraser. He said, "We must go beyond the headlines and dig beyond the story." And that's exactly what we attempt to do each week with the Trumpet Weekly and here on Trumpet Hour. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Hope you have enjoyed it. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.